Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. The White House wants to protect us from financial predators like credit card companies.
The company holds up two or three things to show you, like the nominal interest rate, the free gifts, and the warm and fuzzy relationship.
We'll hear about the goals of Consumer Finance Protection Agency. And it seems like no one in America likes our hodgepodge healthcare system. But across the pond, Britain's National Health Service has lots of fans.
I think the NHS in this country is absolutely marvellous. There is nothing to match it in the world. Absolutely nothing.
Of course, not everybody feels that way. Plus, it's Father's Day, time to remember all those money lessons from Dad.
When I grew up and found myself walking 30 blocks to save $2 on the subway, I realized I had turned into a version of my father.
And we lunch with a man who had lunch with Warren Buffett for $650,000. It's all up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. The Consumer Product Safety Commission protects you from faulty cribs, exploding batteries, and hoodies that could accidentally strangle your kids. But there's nothing to protect you from an exploding mortgage or a credit card with an interest rate that could strangle your finances. That may be about to change. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren has been in the headlines recently because she's the watchdog over the TARP money being doled out to the nation's banks. But we're talking to her because of her previous activism on another issue that came to the fore this week. 2 years ago, she wrote an article proposing the idea of a financial product safety commission. She argued that we consumers needed the same protection for our finances that we get for the toys and appliances we buy. Well, this week, the Obama administration proposed just such an agency. Elizabeth Warren, welcome to Marketplace Money. And how about we talk about something other than TARP?
Oh, I'd like that.
Okay. So when you first proposed this idea 2 years ago, what were you seeing in the marketplace that prompted your concern? Was it a specific financial product?
No, it's that the marketplace is broken. Put four credit card contracts down on a table and try to make a comparison. Try to figure out which one's cheaper. Try to figure out which one's safer. It's not possible. The average contract is more than 30 pages long. And let's face it, most of the terms are written in a form of legalese that even a Harvard law professor would have a lot of trouble with. And what that means is that we've switched over to a different kind of pricing model for credit cards. The company holds up two or three things to show you, like the nominal interest rate, the free gifts, and the warm and fuzzy relationship. And then they build all the so-called revenue enhancers into that 30 pages of unreadable text. So if you can't tell whether card A, card B, card C, or card D is the cheaper card or the better card, the market isn't working.
Well, explain what we're talking about when we compare the Consumer Product Safety Commission with something that would be similar for really non-tangible products. You know, one is about protecting us from, I don't know, exploding car gas tanks and lead toys. This one would protect us from what beyond credit cards?
The idea behind both of them is it protects us from the things we can't see. The notion is markets don't work when certain elements of the competition or certain elements among the products are not visible. So what happened in the case of the Consumer Product Safety Commission basically is they just said, look, here are the minimum safety standards. So if you want to compete, find other ways. Don't compete by taking out the insulation and making your manufacturing cheaper. It's really the same thing with credit cards. All we're saying here is don't compete by hiding a bunch of terms in 30 pages of incomprehensible text. Put the product right up front, anyone can see it, and make a good decision.
What do you see as the tipping point from the need for regulation to the need for personal responsibility? I mean, at some point, shouldn't we all recognize that credit cards are not inherently safe for us?
You bet. The Financial Protection Agency is not about protecting consumers from themselves. You go out to the mall and spend $2,000 on things you can't afford, by golly, you ought to be responsible for it. What this is about is the heart of personal responsibility. It's hard to have personal responsibility if someone is trying to trick you or deceive you about what the terms of the agreement are. My view on this is let's put that all out front. Let's have plain vanilla products, and then they should be responsible for honoring those contracts.
You know, this isn't all about incomprehensible contracts and language. Isn't this agency supposed to be able to stop some financial products from even getting out on the market?
It's about dangerous products and about what consumers can understand. Let me give you the best example I can. And that is, I was in a hearing before Congress, and one of the senators asked the bank executive sitting next to me to explain double cycle billing.
And the bank good luck with that.
The bank executive mumbled and fumbled and started and tried again and finally said, I can't. Hmm. Well, my view is, if you can't explain it, then you can't sell it.
Again, I think the question is, will this agency potentially be able to stop such destructive practices as not just credit cards, but, you know, like the option arm? Will that still be available to people, even though it is so hard to understand?
There may be a place for complicated financial products. For people in certain circumstances, it may be appropriate, but it's appropriate only if there has been enormously careful disclosure and qualification of that customer for that kind of product. This is not about limiting consumer choices. This is about making sure that those choices are real. For most of us, that means plain vanilla products.
But would an agency like this be able to prevent, say, mortgage brokers from offering a mortgage like that?
You know, the key thing is it would prevent mortgage brokers from deceiving people about these mortgages. That's been a large part of the problem we've got right now. People have been steered into products that are entirely inappropriate for them and that were never fully explained. That's the practice that will be stopped.
Elizabeth Warren, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, Tess.
Daddy.
Something occurred to me. I was just listening to your interview there with Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, yeah.
And, well, you know, I like to think in sort of lateral ways about these things, and I have to tell you...
I don't have a whiteboard in here, I'm sorry.
No, that's cool. That's cool. But I can do it sort of in a alliterative fashion by talking about cheese.
Okay. Patty Hirsch, Marketplace Senior Editor, commenting on my Elizabeth Warren interview.
Yeah, it's about cheese.
Cheese.
Yeah, cheese. Yeah, you like cheese, right?
I love cheese.
Okay, yeah, Portland, you know, it's a big cheese producer these days.
Yes,
right?
Tillamook Cheddar, yeah, one of my favorites.
Go. Yeah. So she's talking about loan products and the control of the kind of loan products and it kind of come onto the market, right?
Right.
And I was thinking about the ideal supermarket stacked with cheese of all different varieties from all around the world and no control on what type of cheese, any type of cheese you want, you can just put it in that supermarket and you can pick any old cheese that you want. Except that what's happening is this agency that they're talking about is going to step in and say, there are certain types of cheese that you can't have.
So this would be the FDA equivalent?
Exactly.
For the financial industry?
Exactly. It's the financial product scientists in white coats. They're going to be looking at all the cheese that come in. They're going to have certain types of disclosure on these cheese. Everybody knows what types of cheese there is or what the calories are, the calorie count. And in some of the cases of these cheeses, and this is a big concern of people on Wall Street in particular, they are worried that this agency is going to say there are certain types of cheeses, like those stinky cheeses from France, you know, the really young, unpasteurized one, that we are not going to allow on this supermarket shelf.
Well, in the case of cheese, that's a bummer. But in the case of an option arm mortgage, I'm not sure that would be a bummer.
Well, maybe if you're the kind of person who doesn't know one cheese from another mm-hmm. and can't tell the difference between Tillamook and Le Chevalier. But if you are a cheese connoisseur or a loan connoisseur, you might be pretty upset that you can't have your full range of choice of cheese or loans.
Cheese and loans. Oh, well, thanks for coming in, Patty. Next time, please don't do that before lunch.
Well, actually, I'm a bit peckish now, actually. And look at me crackers.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivin Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivin.com. By Gather.com, where friends keep up with people, conversations, and moments that matter. People are talking about their family's economy at Gather.com. And by SaveAndInvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at SaveAndInvest.org.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story, and our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is with me once again. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
So, I understand you want to talk about healthcare, and I understand that everybody is talking about healthcare, but we had this conversation a year ago, and I think we had it the year before that.
Yes. Every 2 decades, we have a movement toward a major change in our healthcare system. But what really matters now is that the momentum toward healthcare reform is happening in Washington, D.C. The next several weeks, we're either going to see, are the prospects toward reform going to continue to grow, or does it come to a stop? So I think now is the time to pay attention.
Well, if folks do feel like they want to get involved in this debate, what kinds of things should they be looking out for in terms of what's really going to be pushed on Capitol Hill?
Okay, so the two main topics here are cost and coverage. So two hot button issues. One is being called, you hear this jargon term, the public option. The government will create its own health insurance company, a little bit along the lines of Medicare. That's a hot button issue. That's one. Second one, taxes. How are we going to pay for it? Are we going to change the way employer-provided health insurance is taxed? Because it isn't taxed. Are we going to start putting a tax on there?
So this would be a tax of the benefits that you receive through your employer for health care?
Correct.
So where do you come down on this? What do you want to see happen?
I want to see universal coverage. That's what I really want to see. I want to see universal coverage. If I were to be the health czar, I would sever the link between your job and your health insurance.
So the employer would not provide that for you?
Absolutely not. They can provide extra benefits, but it wouldn't matter. You lose your job, you still have your health insurance. That, to me, would be an ideal world.
You're essentially saying that you would go for a single-payer system where the government is the provider?
Oh, no. We got plenty of insurance companies competing for my business. Chris Farrell, Tess Vigeland, they can compete for our business, but I own it, not the company. You know, even as we come out of this great recession, there's going to be a lot of layoffs, there's going to be a lot of churn. So it's part of the safety net. And it makes no economic sense to me that if someone loses their job, their family loses their health care. And don't tell me that COBRA covers it, because COBRA is so expensive, very few people who lost their job can pay for it, even with the new subsidy. It makes no sense. It's inefficient and it's immoral.
So are you willing to lay down a bet that this is actually going to happen this year?
Yes. We've had 6 attempts at universal health care coverage over the past century. This is going to be a historic marker. We're going to cross over the line.
All right. We'll see if it comes true. Thanks, Chris.
Yes, and I'm sure you'll remind me. Thanks a lot, Tess.
If you hate dealing with copays and preferred providers, try this on for a guiding principle to health care.
When you are sick, you will be free from the money worries which so often accompany illness.
That's the idea behind Britain's National Health Service. Plus, a guide to some free fresh air this weekend as national parks waive their fees. It's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Miglund. With all the talk of healthcare reform in this country, let's get a checkup on how it works somewhere else. In Britain, the government provides healthcare. But while it spends just over 9% of its GDP on health, here in the U.S., we spend 17%. However, there are now warnings that the U.K. system will face a nearly $25 billion deficit over the next decade. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more from London.
Talk to people who use the NHS on a regular basis, like people entering this doctor's surgery in a small town west of London, and you hear a few grumbles. The time it takes to fix an appointment, the fact that the newest, most expensive drugs may not be available. But the overwhelming sense you get is that the NHS is one of Britain's most cherished institutions.
I think the NHS in this country is absolutely marvellous. There is nothing to match it in the world. Absolutely nothing.
Oh, it's very good, as far as I'm concerned, yes. Well, of course, it's always treated me all right.
I think it's very good. It looks after me and at no cost.
And that is the key. The NHS, funded out of general taxation, offers largely free healthcare to all. That is the founding principle of the 61-year-old service, spelt out in 1948 by the Prime Minister of the day, Clement Attlee.
The aim is to ensure that the provision of proper care and treatment shall not depend on financial resources, and that when you are sick, you will be free from the money worries which so often accompany illness.
Over the years, the ever-rising cost of drugs and medical equipment and the increasing numbers of elderly people have put the NHS under pressure. Those pressures are now set to intensify. For 7 years, the government has pumped in record amounts of cash. Now, after all the bank bailouts and stimulus packages, the spending spree is grinding to a halt. Within 2 years, says health service manager Nigel Edwards, the NHS will run out of money.
This is probably one of the most significant financial challenges the NHS has ever faced in its history. Having had 7 years of plenty, it now looks like 7 years of famine from 2011 onwards.
Various remedies have been suggested. One proposal, that patients should, for the first time, be required to pay to visit the doctor. But Dr. Lawrence Buckman of the Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, says no way.
I can see enormous problems in trying to take money off patients who've never paid before for anything, to have to start charging them. I think family physicians would be very, very wary of that.
He says it would end up costing the NHS even more money. People would delay going to the doctor, their condition might worsen, and then become even more expensive to treat. Dr. Buckman doesn't believe big job cuts in the NHS make any sense either.
Once you withdraw the workforce, although that's the biggest expense of the health service, you actually remove the people who do the delivery of healthcare. So that doesn't seem terribly bright.
Or politically palatable. Such is the British people's fierce attachment to the NHS that any hospital closure provokes immediate protest. Even the most conservative politicians have learnt that to cut the NHS is to commit electoral suicide. The opposition Tories are even promising that if they win the next election, they'll cut every other area of spending but not healthcare. Neil Dixon is head of the think tank the King's Fund. He says the NHS is largely untouchable. It's now a bedrock of British life.
It's like a compact between a whole society that says we believe there's something fundamental and intrinsic about healthcare. It's something that people have a right to, and that we're determined that whether you're the rich man at the castle or the poor man at the gate, you will get the highest possible service that we as a society can afford.
Some economies are inevitable. Some services like cosmetic surgery, fertility treatment and sex therapy may be massively reduced. Staff will have to work harder and smarter. There'll be more contracting out. But no one seriously believes that the NHS will not survive its looming cash crisis more or less intact. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace Money.
If you're looking to get out of town this weekend without spending a lot of money, look no further than the National Park Service. This weekend, more than 100 parks around the country are free. You can see the Grand Canyon, Yellowstone, maybe Glacier National Park, without plunking down the usual $25 per car. Earlier this week, I called park ranger Carrie Cobb to talk about what they're expecting at her site, Yosemite.
Typically, on a regular weekend, we see anywhere between 7,000 and 10,000 cars coming in. On a holiday weekend, we can see up to 25,000. And we're kind of expecting that same amount of cars coming in for this free weekend.
That is a lot of cars in Yosemite.
It is.
How does the park prepare to have such an enormous influx of people? I would assume you have to have everything from more rangers to more toilet paper.
Exactly, yes. And we are keeping all that in mind. We do have traffic management. We also will have more, say, maintenance rangers that are going to be available to empty trashes, refill toilet paper. We're going to have more rangers out there having visitor contacts. So if there is an issue, it won't be too hard to find a ranger.
You know, it certainly doesn't sound like Yosemite needs the business if it's full most weekends anyway. So what is the goal of these free weekends at the national parks?
Well, you're exactly right. Yosemite doesn't need the increase in visitors, but those visitors that are coming to the park are going to travel through our gateway communities. Some of them will stay in those hotels. Some of them will stop and have coffee or lunch or even just visit the local store and buy gifts and things like that. And that's going to stimulate our gateway communities.
Carrie Cobb is a park ranger at Yosemite National Park here in California. I have to tell you, you should not be surprised if you see me up there on one of these free weekends. It's just beautiful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And up in my home state of Oregon, Ranger Dylan Carey is waving cars into Crater Lake National Park this weekend, looking for a crowd.
Hopefully a lot of people will come out. Last year we had a slight decrease in numbers with the price of gas. Hopefully with that going down, people will just come out to the park to see one of their greatest natural resources.
Are you finding that because of the economy, people are perhaps changing their plans from, you know, instead of going to a resort somewhere, they're coming somewhere like Crater Lake?
I think that people are traveling closer to home, so we're getting more people from Oregon, and people are changing their plans probably from, you know, flying places to driving or something like that.
And Crater Lake is a great place to drive. I know you can drive all along the rim there. It's beautiful.
Exactly, and to drive to Crater Lake, you know, this part of Southern Oregon is, you know, a gorgeous place.
How did you get into this ranger job?
Actually, both my parents are in the Park Service. That's actually how they met. They met in Florida, and now they're currently in Arizona in Chiricahua National Monument.
Oh, that's terrific. Do you have any specific memories of family vacations at the parks where your folks were working?
Definitely. I mean, working in Canaveral, my dad used to take me out on turtle watches all the time. We'd go out, you know, watch the turtles lay their eggs out on the beaches.
All right. Well, thanks, Dylan.
Okay, have a good day.
And we'll check back in with Carrie and Dylan next weekend to see how things went.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider, helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
It's that time of the show when we answer your personal finance questions, and I'm joined once again by our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, let's go right to the phones. Gary is with us from Lenoir, North Carolina. Hi, Gary.
Hey, how are you?
We're doing all right, and you?
Great, just doing fine.
All right, but you must have a money question for us. How can we help you?
Oh, I've got all kind of money questions. Don't
okay.
have any. What it is, I'm contemplating retirement. I'm 62. I'm in the company's 401, and we're going through a buyout.
What industry are you in?
Telephony. Climb poles, ladders, and that's why I'm retiring at 63. I don't want to be up climbing poles and ladders at that age.
Well, that's understandable.
Anything over that, anyway.
I don't blame you on that.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm in my 401, and, of course, it's been rising and sinking in this turbulent economy. It's gone from 450K down to 130, back up to 3, down to 2, and I'm just getting a little skittish, and I wonder if I should get out or transfer my money to an IRA or IRA Roth, or at age 62, just convert the money, the 401 money, to CDs.
Boy, that is quite a roller coaster that your 401k has been on.
It seems to be, yes.
Chris, is it even possible to take out a 401k while you're still in a job? Don't you have to wait until that ends?
We're going to wait till that ends, and then you're not going to want to withdraw it all at once. And the reason, Gary, is that you'll just have to pay taxes on everything. So we'd at least want to, you know, sort of have some sort of idea or a plan before we do anything dramatic with it. But it does seem to me like you're an awful lot in stocks. I mean, do you have any idea or any sense of how much you have in the stocks?
No, not really. A percentage. Yeah, I do have 20% in the company stock.
But in general, you must be pretty heavily in stocks overall, otherwise you wouldn't have such massive swings.
Well, that's another thing. We're just financially embarrassed to not know what to ask or what to do. I've got two books from my advisor, the group that handles our account, and one's 101 pages and one's 62 pages.
Yeah, well, you're certainly not alone there in not knowing what questions to ask. I think we all face that when we're talking with our financial advisors. So, Chris, what's the main thing to do with this 401k money as he contemplates a buyout?
Okay, well, I got a couple of thoughts, but my main message, Gary, to you and to anybody listening to this, you should never be embarrassed about your 401k, your money, what's going on. So the first thing, I got warning bells going off, 20% in the company stock. That's a very risky position. That's where people have gotten into a lot of trouble. Second point, we've got to find out how much you have in stocks because you want to be conservative. And I have a thought, who's the provider? What's the financial institution that you work with in your 401k?
Talking about like Vanguard or Fidelity?
Right.
Yeah, it's Fidelity. I do have some more in a Vanguard, but that's in the wife's name.
Okay. So either Vanguard or Fidelity, both offer very, very low-cost financial planning service. Work with them and come up with a plan. And you're just going to emphasize again and again, I am conservative. I don't want to be at risk.
And Chris, what about his question of what to do with the 401k money once he does retire in a year or so?
Okay, so this is part of where you're going to create a plan. Because my guess is, Gary, you might want to lock in part of the value of your 401k. And then, you know, depending on how you can take the money out, there'll be this question, do you take out some of that money as an annuity? Or are you going to take it out as a lump sum, do a rollover into an IRA, and then do some other things with it? These are the kinds of things we need to explore. You know, it's easy to get lost in the short run, but you got time for it. You're not even going to retire until you're 63.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help you out, Gary?
Yeah, I appreciate that information.
Okay, well, thanks so much for the call.
And thank you so much.
And Chris, next we have an email from Anne in Newcastle, Maine. She's in somewhat of a holding pattern and wants to know if what she is experiencing is typical. She and her husband both have credit scores over 800. Woo! And they owe less than 50% on their house. But earlier this year, they did apply to refinance, but they're having trouble getting that refinancing process through. They say the bank just keeps saying that they're basically overwhelmed. They're behind on processing these loans. So she's wondering what the holdup is. Should they wait or should they try to find another bank?
I'm not particularly surprised. I'm disappointed because it strikes me as, boy, they're a slam dunk for a refinancing. I guess my bottom line would be shop around and buy yourself a little bit of a safety net in case the bank doesn't get its act together.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the questions we can take for this week. But Chris is answering your questions all day long on his Getting Personal blog. That is at our website, marketplace.org. Go ahead and check that out. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We've been hearing for a long time now about the subprime mortgage crisis. Well, the problem is quickly moving into a different area of the housing market. Prime borrowers are defaulting on their loans and foreclosing on their homes. Now, these borrowers boasted good credit ratings. They had fixed rate mortgages. They didn't buy homes they couldn't afford. But they are now in trouble. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has our story.
When economist Patrick Newport of IHS Global Insight scanned the latest statistics from the Mortgage Bankers Association, he didn't like what he saw.
These were horrible numbers.
What caught Newport's attention is that prime borrowers are now falling behind at a record pace. These are people with good credit scores, many in conventional 30-year mortgages with reasonable interest rates. And nearly 1 in 10 of them is in trouble, behind on their mortgage or already in foreclosure. That's double the number last year. It's what economists are calling the third wave of the mortgage crisis. In the first wave, speculators dumped houses as prices plummeted. In the second, sketchy borrowers lost their homes as the payments on their adjustable-rate subprime mortgages soared. Now, the problem has shifted again.
And in this case, what's driving the numbers are the job losses, and they're likely to continue driving the numbers because of the high unemployment rates that we're expecting.
To see how the crisis is building, I headed to the little town of Carlton, Oregon. There's a thriving wine industry and some timber mills not doing so well. Craig Wright works in one of those mills when there's work and lives with his daughter in one of several new housing developments in the area. It backs up on a meadow and acres of wetlands.
This is just a little trail that we keep clear for hiking. We've got deer, pheasant, quail. Just a nice little place to be.
Wright's nice little place cost him $257,000. He has good credit and put 20% down, so he got a fixed-rate 30-year mortgage that costs $1,800 a month. He's been struggling to make the payments since the mill cut back on work in February.
At work, we've been doing what we call curtailment, so basically I'm working about half the time that I normally do. So I do have what I call a nest egg saved up, and that's what I'm able to dip into and make my payments. But, of course, that only lasts so long, and then what?
Wright's trying to get a loan modification through the Obama administration's homeowner assistance program before he runs out of money. He wants to lower his monthly payments by $500. Wright and borrowers like him may have a hard time refinancing their mortgages to take advantage of lower interest rates. If a homeowner's income has gone down or they owe more on the house than it's worth, they may not qualify. And that's the case all the way up the housing ladder. Plenty of people who had large incomes and took out large mortgages are also in trouble. Foreclosures on jumbo loans, those worth more than $729,000 in the top markets, more than doubled at the beginning of 2009. Many of these homes were purchased with so-called creative financing, adjustable-rate mortgages with optional payment schedules, or loans that didn't require proof of income. Some of these are now resetting at higher interest rates, but with home prices collapsing, the borrowers can't easily refinance. Selling means taking a huge loss. This situation creates losers as well as winners.
You know, I was looking for houses in my neighborhood, and I saw a house, great location, and the price just didn't make sense.
Kathy Satis is a lawyer and former coworker of mine in Portland. She has a teenage daughter. Her mom visits for a few months at a time, so she's looking for a bigger place. She bid on this sprawling ranch house a few blocks from where she lives.
And it sold in 2006 for $800,000. The asking price was $595,000. Maybe this is an opportunity to get a great house at a great price.
This is a short sale. The owner's in default on the mortgage, so the bank's trying to sell the house at a loss to avoid foreclosure. It's a complicated and time-consuming process. Knowing it's a distressed property, Satis has bid below the asking price, which is just what savvy buyers are doing all over the country as delinquent and foreclosed properties flood the market and continue to fuel this vicious economic cycle. In Portland, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
Most of us learn about saving and managing money from our parents. But here's one who took the term cold hard cash to the extreme.
Rather than invest his money in the markets, he literally stuffed them into checkbook boxes and stuck them in the freezer.
We'll hear money advice from dear old dads, including Warren Buffett. It's all coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. What would you pay for a private audience with an oracle? Say we toss in a swanky Manhattan lunch and you can bring along a few friends. Well, for a minimum of $25,000, you could have lunch with Warren Buffett. For the past 10 years, the Oracle of Omaha has auctioned himself off to the highest bidder, with all proceeds going to a San Francisco charity called the Glide Foundation. This year's auction begins this weekend on eBay. I simply don't have the cash. Last year's winner paid more than $2 million. But we settled on the next best thing.
Hi.
Hi. I have a reservation for Vigeland.
Okay. Head this way.
My lunch took place earlier this week in Irvine, California, at Zove's Cafe and Bar. It's a local joint near Monish Pabrai's house. 2 years ago, he was the highest bidder for the Buffett lunch.
Monish, hi. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Tess.
Shall we have a seat and have lunch?
Oh, that'll be great.
All right. Remind us what you paid to sit and have lunch with Warren Buffett.
Well, the lunch went for $650,100. I had co-bid with a friend of mine, and so he paid one-third, I paid two-thirds.
That's a lot of money for lunch.
Well, I think that's one way to look at it. But we were very willing to make the bid for the Glide Foundation, even if there was no lunch associated with it. I thought of the lunch as actually a bonus. My drive was really just to thank Warren for all the enormous impacts he had in our lives.
What kind of impact did he have on your life?
I'm a money manager, and I learned my craft from following Warren's intellectual property, if you will. And, the way I looked at it is that if we lived in the time of Galileo or Newton or Einstein, and you got a chance to spend, two or three hours with them, whatever price tag would you put on that?
When you talk about how he has had an effect on your life beyond money issues, what do you mean?
If you look at Warren's approach to living, approach to family, his approach to the way he approaches friendships, I think the simplicity and the focus on a great life has been a huge impact.
So how have you put that into effect in your life and your business?
First of all, in my business, I run a value fund, and it's very similar to what Warren Buffett ran in the 50s and 60s. So that has very direct impacts. But also in terms of the way we live our lives, I think we've learned to keep it simple. We've learned to look at what Warren would call an inner scorecard.
Do you know what you want?
I'm here all the time, so I know. In fact, he knows what I want.
I know this guy very well.
So. I'll take the club sandwich and an iced tea, please.
And for you? Chicken kebab, spicy.
Yeah.
All tomato, cucumber.
That's right. Yeah, right. That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The thing about Buffett is that he's extremely well documented. There have been more books written on him than I think any of the other guys. In many ways, it's like, I would say, being part of a religion. If you were a Christian and you were contemplating some action, you could always ask yourself the question, what would Christ think of this?
So that's Warren Buffett for you?
So, in fact, many times my wife jokes with me. She says, sometimes if she sees behavior that she doesn't appreciate, she says, now Warren wouldn't be doing that.
What would Warren do?
Yeah, or she'd even just say that he wouldn't do that. So, but the thing is, I think it's very important in life to have heroes. It just so happens that my hero is alive when I'm alive. And my hero actually is willing to accept a bribe to sit down for a meal. So we paid the bribe and we got the meal.
Let's talk a little bit about the lunch.
Okay.
Who went with you?
Yeah. So
where was it?
It was at Smith & Wolensky's Steakhouse in New York. And I went with my wife and two daughters, Monsoon and Momachi. They were 10 and 12 years old at the time. And then my friend Guy Spear, who co-bid with me, came with his wife, Lori Spear. So there were six of us and then Warren. And the lunch went for, over 3 hours.
3 hours?
Yeah, so it's not like you're in and out quickly. And I think in about 5 minutes, Warren makes you very comfortable so you don't feel intimidated.
And how does he do that?
Before he came to the lunch, he actually knew quite a bit about each of us. He came with gifts for both my daughters.
Oh.
And effectively with bags of candy. They had just invested in Mars. And so he brought M&Ms with his picture on them. So he won them over right away. And then he told them, they were sitting on either side of him. And he told them, they both ordered hamburgers. And he said, if there's anything you guys leave on your plates, I will finish it off. And he said, I only eat what I used to eat at the age of 5. In fact, the 3 kids at the table, you know, Warren and my daughters.
Well, what about some of the questions that you asked Warren while you had him captive at the restaurant? What did you want to know?
Well, you know, after the lunch, what I did is I exit interviewed everyone who was there. You know, my daughters, and I basically made notes. And we finally, I think, came out with that there were 54 different threads to the conversation.
Different topics.
So it covered quite a bit of...
In just three hours.
Yeah, because we were just going nonstop, right? And there was a very wide range of things covered. And so, for example, Warren told my daughters that the single most important decision they would make in their lives was who they decided to marry.
Hmm.
And I think that that's something that still sticks with them. They actually think about that. We talked, Harina and I talked to him quite a bit, very specifically about inheritance and philanthropy.
And what was his answer there? Because he is famous for basically saying that his children are not going to get everything, and that's why so much of his money has gone to the Gates Foundation.
That's right. And in fact, it's a decent amount is going to the children's foundations, but not to the children themselves.
Right, right.
Buffett says that leave enough money for your kids for them to do anything they want, but not enough for them to do nothing. And I think that's a very good philosophy, because you don't want to kind of distort or affect what they would have normally accomplished. So, of course, the question is, what is that number, right? And what is that amount? And that amount probably varies.
Lunch is here?
Yeah, lunch looks great.
Good French fries.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And a spicy kebab.
Oh, thank you.
There you are. Everything look all right?
Looks wonderful.
Looks great.
Great, enjoy.
Thanks,
thank
man.
You.
You're welcome.
So, my wife's perspective on inheritance is that we should give money away, but we should try to give the kids a substantial amount as well. My perspective has been that, well, maybe not so substantial. But it was good to hear Warren's perspective. I don't think we fully bridged our gaps, but they're not too far apart.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'll let you take a few bites there.
Yeah, sure.
So your bid was in 07?
Yes. We bid in 07. It just so happened with calendars and everything else that we met in 08.
So how much did you talk about money?
Money meaning like investing?
Yeah.
Actually, we spent no time discussing investing, almost no time.
I know he says, you know, one of the rules is he's not going to talk specific
stocks.
Yeah,
I think it's a waste of time to talk to Warren about stock tips. I think there's so much more wisdom outside of that. Went a step further, he said, Monish, if you are just a slightly above average investor but have extreme patience, you cannot help but get rich over time.
So did you, when you went to the lunch, did you go with a written list of questions that you wanted to ask? Or
I did make a list just to organize my thoughts, but I didn't take it with me to the lunch.
Mm.
My younger daughter actually threw Warren off guard because she... suddenly brought up, she said, yes, was it hard when your wife left you? So
wow.
His first wife, Susan Buffett, in the 70s, left Omaha, moved to San Francisco. And I think the question caught Warren off guard. I could see his eyes well up, but I think it took him just a few moments, then he was in control. And then I think we spent the next 40 minutes on Susan.
You mentioned earlier that he is... well documented, lots of books about him,
yes.
a million magazine articles. Was there anything through the lunch that you learned about him that you didn't already know that surprised you?
It's like I felt I was sitting with my grandfather. It's very old school. I think you, it's almost like you're back in the 50s. So it's almost like a time warp. So that to me was very surprising.
And what kind of tipper is he?
When we ended the lunch, I wanted to tip the waiters, and I reached my wallet, but I was too slow. So Warren had his wallet out, and he left $200 on the table. So even though he's very careful about how he spends money, I think he wants to make sure people who are doing their thing are well taken care of. And in fact, my daughters were commenting about his wallet. There was a big stack of hundreds. It was pretty funny.
They'd like your wallet to be full of those, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I don't have as many hundreds, no.
Well, Manesh, it's been a pleasure having lunch with you and talking about your lunch with Warren Buffett. Thanks so much.
Well, Tess, it's always a pleasure. I'm a big fan of Marketplace. Look forward to listening.
If you want to hear about Warren Buffett's early experimentation with shoplifting, yes, the Oracle himself, you can listen in on my entire lunch conversation with Monish Pabrai on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It is Dad's Day this weekend, and that means lots of ties being opened, new barbecue tools making their debut, maybe some sweet seats at a ball game. Or perhaps you have one of those dads, the kind where the best gift you could give is finding the cheapest gas station in town or remembering to turn off the faucet while you brush your teeth. We learn a lot from our parents, including our views about money. Lauren Weber's dad had a big impact on her financial life. He taught economics at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, and man, did he bring those lessons home.
It gets really cold in New England in January, but that didn't stop my father from tyrannically setting the heat at 50 degrees during the winters of my Connecticut childhood. It was so chilly that I had to wear a hat and gloves in the house just to stay warm. There was no point in whining about the cold. Put on another sweater, my dad would say in his native New York accent. You see, my father is cheap. Really cheap. When I was growing up, he was always dashing around the house, turning off lights and monitoring thermostats. He insisted on washing dishes with cold water and no soap, so our knives and forks were usually encrusted with the remains of recent meals. He used hand signals out the window of his car to preserve the turning lights, and he still tries to avoid using the brakes on the car by coasting to red lights or using a tap and thrust system that he thinks is easier on the brake pads. He even tried to ration toilet paper, telling my brother and sister and me how much we could use for each bodily function. Thank goodness these rules were too hard to enforce and were never mentioned again. But whenever we're all visiting, he still shouts out as he turns in for the night, "Please don't flush until the last person goes to bed." I complained bitterly about all of this when I was young. But when I grew up and found myself walking 30 blocks to save $2 on the subway, I realized I had turned into a version of my father. What surprised me most was how grateful I felt. My father did pass on some of his compulsive behavior, but he also taught me an essential lesson, how to live within my means. He taught me to distinguish between needs and desires, and to deprive myself of ephemeral things in favor of more meaningful ones. Thanks to these lessons, I've never been in debt, I've traveled all over the world, and I've chosen work that I love. Most importantly, he taught me to be generous when it matters. Dad may be a little crazy when it comes to turn signals and toilet paper, but he would give anything to a friend or a stranger in need. He showed me that self-denial is a virtue only when coupled with compassion and an open hand. So thanks, Dad, and happy Father's Day.
Lauren Weber's book, In Cheap We Trust, will be published in September. Weber was inspired to write the book based on her father's example. We asked a few listeners to tell us some other money lessons they learned, and perhaps didn't, from dear old Dad.
I didn't get direct advice from my father. He led by example, and the biggest example was you marry somebody who is very good with the money and get out of their way. My mother got an MBA when I was 8 years old, but the beginning years of my life, my dad was a sole breadwinner, and he came home, told my mother how much the paycheck was, and then she did the budget and said, okay, you can have lunch at work 2 days this week. The rest of the time you have to bring in your own lunch. And he just followed her advice. Once I met my wife on one of our first dates, she had mentioned that she had a coupon for a particular restaurant to go to. There was no, we have to pull out all the stops and don't be cheap. She was money conscious from the very first day I met her.
My father didn't give me any advice on personal finance. It was considered a private matter. Almost like you don't talk about sex, you don't talk about family finance. We never knew what was spent on anything, on the mortgage or cars. About the only thing I knew was how much a popsicle cost. The only contact I recall about financial matters was when I was going to college and my father presented me with loan papers and told me to sign at the bottom if I wanted to go to college. I'd gotten out of school and just gone on my merry way and eventually got letters from the people that loaned the money demanding their money.
My father really believed in cash that he could see and touch. So rather than invest his money in the markets, he literally stuffed them into checkbook boxes, wrapped them in freezer paper, wrote the word beans on the outside, and stuck them in the freezer. My father called the money beans because accountants are called bean counters. So that was his code, because he thought maybe simoleons was a little bit too obvious. I learned from my father that financial acumen was not connected to the Y chromosome.
Our thanks to Colin Shaw of Morgan, Utah, Keith Neely of Alameda, California, and Martha Catt of Charlotte, North Carolina for sharing their stories with us. And thanks also to the most generous, wise, and kind-hearted father a gal could ask for. Love you, Dad. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, we visit the unbanked population of Los Angeles. A new program is trying to get them banked.
People joke around about it, but they really put it underneath the couch or the mattress. But what we also try to teach them is that if there's a robbery in your home or, you know, there's a fire, your money's gone.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tessa Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.